suburb of Berlin, in a great palace in it. And it was at the Wannsee Conference where Hitler and his all of his great lieutenants decided on a so-called solution of the Jewish problem, meaning kill all the Jews. The solution to the Jewish problem was put into the hands of fellow Austrians. Hitler was an Austrian. Himmler was an Austrian. Heydrich was an Austrian. Eichmann was an Austrian. And Eichmann's deputy was Alois, A-L-O-I-S, Alois Brunner. And Eichmann deputized Brunner to carry out the solution of the Jewish problem. Since they were concerned about what would be the reaction on the rest of the world and so on, they decided to pick the start as an out of the way place. And they decided to start in Salonika in Greece. Salonika had one of the most interesting Jewish assemblages in all of Europe. They had a Jewish community, there was a Jewish community of 52,000 with chief rabbis and so on who administered the whole Jewish community. It was an ingrown Jewish community, and it was rather very successful. It controlled the port at Salonika. There were 52,000 Jews there, and they received an allocation from the Greek governments so they could carry out this little government inside the Greek government. Brunner set up the plan that he later on used all through the entire solution of the Jewish problem. That was this: to get the Jewish community first to deliver the names of all the Jews in the community. Secondly, to say to the leaders of the Jewish community, not that we're sending them to a death camp, but we're sending them to one of those places as a work camp. And then promising the leaders that if they carried out what Brunner himself suggested, the leaders themselves would not be affected, so on and so forth. And so, Brunner asked in the first place they deliver 100 Jews. First, the names and addresses of all the Jews in the community. Secondly, deliver 100 Jews. Sometimes they put them on a railroad car and ship them off, allegedly to a work camp, but it was actually direct to a death camp. Sent them right to Auschwitz, and to be destroyed immediately. But first they asked for only 50, then 100, then 100, 2 weeks, then 100 a day. Until out of the 52,000, they destroyed 50,000 of the Jews of Salonika. This job was so well done by Anton Brunner, by Alois Brunner, that Eichmann then chose him to carry out exactly the same kind of programs in Amsterdam, in Copenhagen, in Vichy, every place else. And Barbie, for example, Lyon. He worked for Alois Brunner. They all worked for Brunner. Brunner told them what to do and so on and so forth. But Brunner is the real deputy of whom Eichmann himself said he was my finest deputy. Anyway, in the Nuremberg trial, and so-called the whole solution of Jewish problem, 6 million Jews were killed in the process. But I would say maybe a million or two of them who weren't killed in battle and shot and killed in other ways were due to Eichmann himself, due to Alois Brunner. Alois Brunner, during the Nuremberg trials in 1947, there was another man by the name of Anton Brunner who was distantly related to Alois Brunner, but he was a little guilty, but not much. He helped somewhere. He was hung. They hung the wrong man. The man is Alois Brunner. And Alois Brunner has been protected ever since the fall of Hitler by all the Western allies because they wanted from him all the information he had against communism in all of Europe. And he fled to various countries. When he fled to South America, to Bolivia, and when Eichmann was captured in Bolivia, he went to Egypt. And when Egypt made the deal with Israel, he went to Damascus. And he's now in Damascus under the protection of Safad, who is the president of Syria. In the TWA case of a year and a half or 2 years ago, Assad seemed to take the first few steps of being friendly with America. And the TWA case, so he made a deal and so on and so forth. Since then, my daughter, who has traced him and has been trying to reopen the Nuremberg trials. And the reason she wants to Nuremberg, because all the governments, the United States and France and Italy and England, they all collaborated with Hitler on something or other. Mm-hmm. And immediately after the war, took on their missile experts and their all kinds of experts and so on and so forth, you see. And they've sealed all the papers of the Nuremberg trials, so the scholar cannot have access to them. The only people who can have access to the Nuremberg papers are the 13 governments which took part in the Nuremberg trials. Mm-hmm. Not one of those governments, now of course Israel wasn't created, it wasn't a state yet in those days, you know. And therefore, not one of those governments ever asked, even though 40 years has gone by, for them to open these papers. But now Israel is urging the American government, because now most of the people are dead who took part in it. But at least there are records. And there are records, for example, vis-a-vis Kurt Waldheim. There are records of a few more people who still have a very high position. Mm-hmm. And therefore they're trying to keep these records sealed until the last important people are dead, and then maybe they'll open them. But my daughter's in the process now of trying to persuade the Israeli government, she has persuaded the Israeli government, to ask the American government to try to open the Nuremberg papers. Yeah. And Mary works with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, who publish all her papers.
You also said she just attended a 40th anniversary of the Holocaust in Oxford.
She was just married, just returned the day before yesterday from Oxford University, where she led a seminar on the Holocaust.
Is she short his name?
Pardon?
Lois.
Mary Lowenthal Felstetter.
Mary
Lowenthal Felster, F-E-L-S-T-I-N-E-R. And her husband, John Felstener, is also an authority on the Holocaust. And he too was invited to read a paper at Oxford University, where all the leading authorities in the world were brought together to make a lasting record of the events of the Holocaust.
From what you say, your daughter was very much influenced with that.
My daughter was
because of your experiences in your life.
No, and the interesting thing is my daughter was not.
No.
I like to believe that, but my wife and I were so busy traveling all across this country for Israel and general democratic causes and humanitarian causes. And our children were rather small. And my daughter went to Rosh Hashanah Temple and just went to Sunday school there. We had very little impact on her during her formative years. The big impact on her were the events themselves and her husband, who became very much involved. I They've both been exchange professors at the university and so on. So anyway, you know, I'd like to go back myself to the beginning. First, I'd like to go back to Yale.
Good.
To where?
To Yale.
To Yale University. The reason I want to go back to Yale, I was a poor little Jewish boy from Newport, Kentucky. My parents had 8 children. I was second oldest. And my father struggled economically. But I decided to go to Yale and to work my way through Yale. I worked my way through Yale College and Yale Law School. And the reason I say that is that all my classmates knew that I was working my way through because I waited on the table, I tutored. A lot of them were so busy in activities at Yale and so on for the prom committee and all these committees and so on. I didn't know anything about these things. I just studied, see. And so I did tutoring and so on and so on. The reason I bring this up is this. In my whole life since then, I entered Yale in 1916, I have never yet had a single illustration, episode, or evidence of any one of my classmates ever saying, holding it against me because I was a Jew. But I don't have a single, on the contrary, I would say that I was considered as an equal at all times, and that was on the social, educational, ordinary student exchange level, with the exception, one exception. I was never asked for a fraternity, because all fraternities didn't take any Jews, and I was never asked to be any part of that system, which played a rather important part in Yale in those days. However, among my classmates, there were Henry Luce, Thornton Wilder, Reginald Marsh, the great American painter, Hugh Auchincloss, H-U-G-H-U, stepfather of Jackie Kennedy. There were Rockefellers and Morgan. There were people I have mentioned. I want to put one more name there, Seymour Knox. Probably Albright Knox, for whom the Albright Knox Museum in Buffalo is named. These and many others in my class remain during their entire lives as close friends of mine. We were constantly in contact with each other. And at the 50th reunion of my class in 1970, I was chosen as a class orator. Uh-huh. I was also chosen as a class orator in my 65th reunion at Yale, which is the last reunion, official reunion one has at Yale. And I bring this up because all of these people influenced my life. They were all very active in many, many things. Thornton Wilder, of course, is a great writer. And Thornton Wilder, they were all very fond of my wife, too. And we saw them. We used to visit Thornton. He had a place at the Martha's Vineyard. And Thornton never married. And his sister Isabel was his editor, and Isabel still remains one of our closest friends. Thornton sent my wife a book autographed and presentation copy for practically for many of her birthdays. And we became rather important collectors. We have practically everything Thornton has written autographed in the presentation copy. Henry Luce.
Excuse me, can we just back up on Thornton Wilder a little bit? Can you tell us a little bit more about him or why, perhaps what qualities he had that made him
I want to tell a story about Thornwilde that I really do, and it involved, it sounds like name dropping, but I must say that this has been my life. And for example, among the, I want to just mention among undergraduate friends of mine, who were not exactly classmates, but contemporaries of mine at Yale, and we all got mixed up. We all graduated in 1920, but on account of World War I, was mixed up and so on. So for example, Charles Taft, son of William Howard Taft, became a very close friend of mine. Dean Acheson became a very close friend. I tutored Dean Acheson's younger brother and got him into Yale, for example. And I want to mention one other man.
You were telling us a story about Thornton Wilder.
Well, I'll tell you about that in a minute, see. But anyway, and I want to mention Elliot Cohen. Elliot Cohen was a writer for the Yale Lit, Yale Literary Magazine, and he became the first editor of Commentary, of the Jewish Magazine Commentary. Now, on Thornton Wilder, I want to tell you a story. Thornton Wilder's father was a very liberal editor of a newspaper in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. In 1904 or 5, after the Boxer Rebellion, Thornton Wilder's father became the first American consul general to China. William Howard Taft, who was a professor at the Yale Law School when I attended the Yale Law School, and when I was one of the editors of the Yale Law Journal, was a very, very close friend of mine. He had been president of the United States, and after he was president of the United States, he became a professor at Yale, professor of constitutional law at the Yale Law School, and then became the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. When William Howard Taft, his life is as follows. He lived in Cincinnati. He became the dean of Cincinnati Law School, which was not yet a part of the University of Cincinnati in those days. And from then on, his brother, Charles Phelps Taft, was one of the richest men in Ohio, I guess, made him the Secretary of War. And then from the Secretary of War, before that. In 1898, when the United States won the Spanish-American War and we took over the Philippines, Charles Phelps Taft had the President of the United States appoint him as the first Consul General for the Philippine Islands in Manila. One of his first jobs when he went over there was that he decided to create a legislature, just like we have in the United States. I'm going to take all these primitive people, you know, and they're still primitive today if you read about the Marcus case and so on and so forth. Primitive people are going to create a Congress in the Philippine Islands. Then from 1898, I said he became Secretary of War, and then he ran for president in 1907, got elected in 1908, say, so he was president in 1912. Anyway, well, he started in 1898 to set up a Congress in the Philippines, didn't materialize much until he was president of the United States in 1909, isn't it? And in 1909, he was invited by the Philippine government then to come over and dedicate this thing called the First Congress. So he went over there with Mrs. Taft and with his three children, Robert Taft, Charles Taft, his son, and his daughter Helen, his wife. When they got over to Manila, after they dedicated the Congress, they decided to go around the world. Why? The Russian Trans-Siberian Railroad had just been built from Moscow to Vladivostok. And he wanted to ride on it. So from Manila, he had to go to Shanghai first. Mm-hmm. Thornton Wilder's father was the American consul in Shanghai. And Thornton Wilder's father then had entertained William Howard Taft. And this story was told to me by Charlie Taft, young Charlie Taft. And that is this. He says, Elihu says, you're so friendly with Thornton. He says, did Thornton ever tell you the story about our visit to Shanghai? I says, no. I says, what is the story? The story is, you know how big my father was? Well, he says, they wanted to entertain him. And they wanted in those days with a rickshaw. And his father was so big, they had no rickshaw was big enough. And overnight, they built a big rickshaw for William Howard Taft. And they dragged him through the streets of Shanghai, and so on and so forth. So later when I saw Thornton, I said, Thornton, do you remember? He says, you bet I remember. Since then, two or three times, I've talked to Thornton's sister, you know, Isabel, whom we know very, very well, see, who, invariably, when we see her, the first thing she does is tells us the story again about this whole event, see. That's not in American history, but I can tell you that's a real sidelight on American history. But I became very friendly with William Howard Taft when he was professor at Yale because I came from Cincinnati and I told him a story that when I was 9 years old, he was running for president of the United States. They didn't have radios in those days, so they got a brass band. They struck up and they marched through the streets to a public park where they had set up a little stand that he would make the pitch from that stand. See? It was going past where we lived. I got in the parade. I was a little kid, 9 years old then, and I got in the parade, and I said, and I told William Howard, I said, you know, I don't know what you said, for staff, but I want you to know that, you know, he was a tremendous fellow, and when he laughed, his whole body went up and down like this, you know. So I said, you know, I don't know what you saw, but when you opened up, the whole audience started to laugh, and you started to laugh. You must have opened up by telling him a funny story. So I don't understand the story. I can't tell you what the story is. Well, I weighed about 95 pounds. He was so fond of me. You know, he put his arm around me. And Charlie Taft was a classmate of mine. I remember Charlie Taft was the editor-in-chief of the Law Journal when I was a member of the board of the Law Journal. And William Howard Taft was having problems with his son, Charlie. Why? Charlie got married when he was at Yale. And just as the war broke out, and he married the Chase girl, Chase Bronze or whatever. It's up there somewhere near New Haven. And they had a baby. And when the war was over, his wife was pregnant again. And Charlie was back in the law school. And Charlie was the amateur coach of the Yale basketball team. And William Howard Taft, he said, what's the matter with Charlie? I want him to be a great lawyer. He was sitting in law school. He's so busy doing these other things and so on and so forth. Anyway, I was the medium between William Howard Taft and his son, Charlie.
He married a girl, you said, from the Chase family. Was that from Chase Manhattan?
No.
Or Margaret Chase Smith?
No, they're just as rich. I don't know whether it's, but they're very, very rich.
Mm-hmm.
The Chase Bronze Company it is. And it's right outside of New Haven and Hartford, anyway it is. I also like to tell the story that when I got Dean Atz's younger brother into Yale, I tutored him for the exams and so on and so forth. His father was the Episcopal bishop. Dean Atz's father was the Episcopal bishop of Connecticut. And several times he invited me to come up there for lunch on Sunday. I never did accept it, but he did invite me. That's how well I knew them. I knew Dean Atz the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. When I got in trouble with Joe McCarthy,
mm-hmm.
and when I was, when they thought of making me a very high officer in the 0.4 program and so on. Well, Joe McCarthy got my name because I was one of the founders of the Americans for Democratic Action with Hubert Humphrey and Eleanor Roosevelt and Arthur Schlesinger and Helen Kaiserling and so on. And I was the first national co-treasurer Americans for Democratic Action in the United States, and I toured with Eleanor Roosevelt and with all the rest of them to start up chapters for Americans for Democratic Action, raise money for them, and so on and so forth. Among my activities.
Avril Harriman, was he in that?
Yeah. I got to know Avril Harriman because Avril Harriman had graduated from Yale. How did you know that? I tell you that about once before.
Yes.
Avril Harriman was one of these, one of the Roosevelt, kitchen cabinet a bunch of these people I just told about, like Leon Kaiserling and Ben Cohn and Corcoran and so on, and Tugwell. They had a house in right outside of Washington, a very fancy town, what's it called? Right next to Washington.
In Virginia?
No, it's right in Washington, right northwest Washington. Anyway, they had a house. Abel Hiram had his own house. He was a multi-millionaire right next to it. I met there several times with them, and we used to hammer out policy and talk informally about so many things, you know, and so on and so forth. But Abel Harriman was very friendly on Jewish causes, made speeches, dozens of speeches I made with Abel Harriman on Jewish causes. And I had a wonderful experience with Abel Harriman. We went in to see Truman at the White House. And he and I sat in the Oval Office and discussed a couple of things with Truman and so on. Abel Harriman was also very much taken with the first Jewish mayor of in Ireland. I can't remember the name. Anyway, he made five or six talks with him on Jewish causes, by the way, for UJA or bonds. I can't remember what it was in those days, but anyway, that's what I wanted to talk to you about.
You were so close with all these people at Yale, and could you tell us, you said it didn't bother them that you were Jewish, or you never
reacted to it. I never had any evidence in my life.
Do you have any idea how you were so successful about that?
They all knew I was Jewish,
uh-huh.
And they all knew of my interests in Jewish affairs.
Uh-huh.
I was a national chairman of this, a speaker's national chairman of that. My name used to appear in the New York Times, and so my picture in the New York Times, and so on. And invariably, every 5 years of reunion, I'm talking about after our 25th reunion, this is 1945, our 25th reunion, invariably, Henry Luce and all these people, Thornton and so on, used to come to me and ask me about Israel, about the Jewish problem, and so on and so forth. They always wanted to talk to me. And Henry Luce, every time anything exciting happened in Israel, he invariably asked me to come to New York to talk to his editors, which I did. And on two occasions, Henry Luce asked me to go to see Ben-Gurion and to get a story on Ben-Gurion. And I did on two occasions. And I wrote the outline of a cover story in both Time and in Life. I think in Time was in 1945, 46, and I think, no, it was later than that. It was almost right after the 1967 war, 1968, something like that. And
the one after the Suez War in 56?
No. After the very important war, 67 war.
67 war.
Yeah, 67. I think once after the Suez War, and once after the 67 war. That's right.
I saw a copy of a letter that at one time you hoped Henry Luce would meet you in Israel.
He never did. I tried my best to get him. He would go to Egypt, and he would go to Jordan, and Syria, and Lebanon, and everything else. I never could get him to step foot in Israel. That reminds me of a wonderful story. I was very friendly with his wife, Claire, and she was the American ambassador to Italy. So once I was
coming. This is Claire Booth Luce.
Claire Booth Luce. And I was coming back from Israel, and I stopped in Rome. My wife and I, as always, and we went to see them, and so on. While I was in Israel, and usually I used to take one of my kids with me. My son was then, I think, a sophomore or a junior at Harvard. And he was doing his he was in science and in math, and I had him working at the Weizmann Institute. But anyway, while I was there, my son was a good swimmer, and I always gave our children, my wife and I, a project. They'll learn the country through a project. And the project that I gave them that particular summer was to swim in all the waters of Israel. Yeah, swim in the Sea of Galilee, swim in the Mediterranean, but swim in all the little rivers and creeks. Because I wanted to swim in all, because he swam, went to swim there, had to find his way around to swim. He'd learn a little bit more about the country and about the people and so on. So he went down to Eilat, my son did. My son is also a scuba diver. when he was down the A-lot, he was so taken with scuba diving. He said, that's the finest scuba diving in the world down there, called the Shells, whatever you see that. Mm-hmm. When he went back to Harvard, then I went back, through Italy, you know, everyone saw Claire and Harry, and we saw them. Claire Booth was a scuba diver. Mm-hmm. And I thought, now I've got reason for him to go to Israel. Uh-huh. So I told Claire all about that scuba diving, you see, and so on. And I thought, sure, she was going to go to Israel there. And if she went, she would take Lewis with her, because he was always with her, you know. But she never went, and he didn't go either. But once I got a promise from him, he would meet me there. And I showed you the letter where he said, I'll meet you at the King David Hotel. Well, he never made it there. I never saw him there. He never went there.
Did you say his parents were, he was a son of missionaries?
His father was a Christian missionary in China. Uh-huh. And he was born and raised in China. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we called him, Yale, we called him Cheek Loose. Mm-hmm. We never called him Harry or Hank or anything like that, or Henry. We always called him Chink. Mm-hmm. Because he had this sort of high cheekbones, strangely enough, and he felt a little, he was sort of an oddball, because he was born and raised in China, and although the missionaries paid for his tuition at Hotchkiss, then at Yale, they had these arrangements, you know, so on,